something that we do with our studies during the week, midweek studies. People, where they open their Bibles and they read and they turn. But the truth is, when you have guests coming into your services, by and large, we live in a post-Christian age. And even people who have a claim to Christianity, many of them don't know whether Matthew is in the New Testament or the Old Testament. And if you have them turn to the book of Hezekiah, they will spend 40 minutes looking before they act like they've found it. And so they're never going to just go, oh, where's that at? So the process helps speed things along. We're going to be talking, and really, evangelism is not something that's new, and the more that I think that we try to make evangelism some cutting-edge thing, the more we miss the essence of what God designed for it to be. And one of the foundational principles of the church that I work with, and the church that sent that church out, one of the foundational principles that we try to teach people is that when you become a Christian, whether you fully grasp it or not, you become an evangelistic person. When you say, I am going to walk in the steps of Jesus, you're saying, I'm going to be someone who cares about lost people. And so from the very beginning, in our studies, when we study with people, and we have a set of studies that we go through with people, within just a few days of studying, we're going to have a study that's just going to confront that reality that says, listen, here's what Jesus described a follower as. He said a disciple, and this isn't my opinion, it's not human opinion. We use all of these scriptures, all three scriptures of what a disciple is out of the book of John. And it's really clear that a disciple in the book of John is someone who holds to the teachings of Jesus. There's a commitment to truth and to doctrine. That's not popular in our day. We live in a time whenever any truth, as long as you believe anything, is okay. It used to be the fight between the Methodists and the Church of Christ. Well, that fight doesn't go on at all anymore. Now the battle might be between the Muslim and the Christians, and you have Christians now who are saying, well, you know, they're worshiping a God, and it's the same God, and so that's the commitment to truth has been thrown out completely as irrelevant. But John says that that's a mark of a disciple. Another mark of a disciple, Jesus said, is that you love each other. There's a deep and profound commitment to fellowship, not on a pancakes and eggs basis. That's a good thing, by the way, but you guys know what I'm saying. Whenever I grew up, the only time fellowship was mentioned is when we had a fellowship meal. We're having a fellowship meal. So over that meal, you talk with people that you didn't see for that period of time, at least talking with them, but once or twice a year. And so what you were sharing in common really was the food and superficial talk. Well, John 13, Jesus says there's a very pronounced love, a love that he would later say is one like I have for you. So we teach those people that, listen, when you become a Christian, you're making a commitment to obeying, to holding to truth and to finding truth. You're making a commitment to loving each other. And then thirdly, you're making a commitment to bearing fruit. John chapter 15 says, this is my Father glorified that you bear much fruit, so proving to be my disciples. And we let them know in that discussion, somebody say, well, fruit, doesn't that mean maybe it's the fruit of the Spirit? And we can see that, you know, there's no reason to debate that and say, no, it doesn't mean that. But it means that, and it means the reproduction of people. And so a changed life ends up changing lives. And you need to know that when you commit to being a disciple, if you say, I will not be that, you can be a disciple of somebody else, but you can't be a disciple of Jesus. So anything that's really trendy and makes you think this is new and takes away from this foundational, fundamental reality that every believer in Jesus is to be someone who reaches out to and makes to lost people and makes disciples is just something that I think we need to push aside a little bit and go, hold it, it's not that complicated. This is what God called us to be. So as we look at the passage, and again, you've got on the top of your notes, you got the go, and I told Shane, if you notice, there's a little bitty black dot that nobody would notice except for me there, that's somewhere in the area of Tullahoma, okay? It's so small that you may not see it, but that's your world on this world, and that's really where this has got to start from, okay? In Matthew 28, Jesus said this, go to all the peoples of all nations and make them my disciples. Baptize them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teach them to do everything I've told you. And I'll be with you always, even to the end of the world. It's a clear command. And there are some things, that you know that you can get wrong, and it doesn't matter. You know, honestly, there are just some things that it's a matter of personal preference. And a lot of times churches fight over that. But if we don't get this right, then we've missed the essence of Jesus coming to earth. So whatever you guys are doing, you may have some things you go, well, we don't completely agree, or you know, it's sort of like Shane's a University of Missouri graduate, isn't he? I was told that Shane and a University of Tennessee graduate had applied for a job, they applied for a job, and by the way, I'm from Missouri, so you can guess where the bias will, this will be. But these two guys, they applied for the same job, and they sent them both in the interview room together and took the test for about an hour and a half and came back out, and the guy said, sit down, we're going to look over your test, and we'll get back with you. And so they pulled them both back in the room, and he goes, listen, guys, I don't know how to tell you this, but Shane got the job. And the guy from the University of Tennessee was really bothered because he's like, well, why did Shane get the job? Like, did he do so much better on the test than me? And the guy said, well, no, actually, he didn't do a whole lot better than you guys. Missed the same amount of questions. And the guy goes, well, if we missed the same amount of questions, then why did he get the job and I didn't? And the guy interviewing said, well, because one of his wrong answers was better than yours. And the guy said, wrong answer? How could a wrong answer be better? Come on. Well, what was it? He said, well, on question number 17 on this particular question, what did Shane put? He goes, Shane put, I don't have a clue. He goes, that's better. What was my answer? He said, yours was me neither. Now, there are some things you can be wrong on, and it really doesn't matter, okay? Me neither, okay? I don't have a clue. I don't know. But on this one, you've got to get it down, and we've got to get it straight. And one of the things I want you to know is that effectiveness, and this is on your notes, effectiveness requires thoughtfulness. It doesn't mean that it's new and that it's some cutting edge, but it does mean that we have to think. And I like what the Message paraphrase says in Colossians 4:5. And the Message paraphrase, every time I quote the Message, I have to say, it's a horrible Bible to study by, okay? It's horrible. But there are times when you'll read its paraphrase and you go, oh man, that makes that thought come to life. In Colossians 4:5, he says, use your heads as you live and work among outsiders. Don't miss a trick. Make the most of every opportunity. So, whenever Paul is writing to the church at Ephesus, he says, listen, there's going to be some things that you're going to have to do, that you're going to have to think about. That if you're going to be effective with outsiders, it's going to be more than just a casual kind of coincidental thing, but it's going to be an intentional thought process that goes on if you're going to make a difference in people's lives. Now, this morning we're going to break into two segments on how, and again, it's kind of expounding on some of the same stuff that we talked about last time, but maybe going a little bit deeper into some specifics, and we're going to kind of pause along the way, and hopefully we'll have some time for some questions and just some interaction. But what we have found at the Crossings and at Greater Alton in reaching people, there are really two keys to success in connecting people. It's finding people when they're hurting and being able to insert ourselves into their life during the pain. And pain and hardship and hurts are a vulnerable time. The same opportunity that we have as Christians to get into the lives of a hurting person, Satan has an opportunity to get in. We've got lots of stories of people who've went through divorces and went through abuse and went through tragedy, and there's incredibly cool stories that go on, but all of you have stories of people who went through divorce and tragedy, and they became alcoholics, and they just lost their mind, and they went the other way. And the reason that is I think that God made that opening to be something to where it's a chance to infiltrate. And either we'll do it as individuals, or Satan will have people that will jump in. The guy down at the bar will put his arm around the guy whose wife just left him and let him know that, yeah, she's just a loser, and no matter, you had 9 affairs, she still shouldn't treat you this way. Have another beer and go do your thing again. And if somehow we don't find a way to put our arm around him, we're going to miss something. So one of the things that our ministry, and we talked about this last time, is based upon finding hurts and healing them. That's not my phrase years ago at the Crystal Theodore Schuller started off with the idea that I'm going to build a massive sized church, and his foundation for the church was I'm going to find hurts and I'm going to heal them. He just ripped it off of Jesus, okay? He didn't, that's not new, okay? It's like, you know, a house divided against itself won't stand. I thought Abraham Lincoln said that, you know, and then I realized he just plagiarized it. He stole it from Jesus. So hurts are one way when people you can get in. And then the other way that you get into people's lives is through finding yourself in social settings, in settings that are normally fun, just things to where there's a lot of activity. A party is how we would describe it. And somehow you find yourself and you're able to insert yourself into their culture in a way that there may be things going on around you that may not be good, but you in the middle of it as someone who's a believer with deep convictions are living in a way that you display how different you are and how deep of a happiness that God has gave you. So we're going to talk about those two kind of in detail and hopefully give some chance for us to say, okay, what's some ways that we can do that? But you've got to use your heads if you're going to do this. Now then, to find the hurt and heal it, there's some things that I must do. And we're going to be looking at the story of Lazarus and any time that I, you know, teach, I always want to make sure that it kind of makes sense to have a biblical background. You got a better chance of getting it right. And it's not just throwing out, you know, human opinion. But if we'll look at some techniques, if we'll see Jesus coming into this world and making a difference, if we just imitate him. Again, that's why, you know, a lot of books that you'll read, and I know Shane's a big reader, but and I know he runs across these, and you read these books, and they can so complicate evangelism, and it can leave you confused, thinking, I don't know how in the world am I going to reach this culture. And the cool thing about Jesus is he came to the world, and he said, just watch me. Just do what I do. And all that pressure of how are we going to reach the culture, it's all answered. And I'm not opposed. I read a lot of evangelism books too, and a lot of them frustrate me tremendously because they've complicated it to where it's not just do what Jesus did. Watch him, imitate him, get his heart, and you will reach any culture in any time. It's made the gospel culture-proof, no matter what's going on. So if I'm going to find a hurt and heal it, what do I need to do? Well, first of all, I must live a life of love. And this one isn't going to be seen in the text in John chapter 11 as far as the broader text. It may not be seen, but it's there. That one of the things that you find with Jesus is that he was this incredible lover of people. As a matter of fact, in Ephesians 5, 1 and 2, the Bible says this, be imitators of God as dearly loved children, and live a life of love just as Christ loved us and gave himself for us. I grew up in a church that talked about a pattern that we had. And it was a pattern of doctrine. It was a pattern of a systematic theology. And I think there's some strengths in that, and I think there's some weaknesses in that. The strength is it gives us something that's tangible that we can look at. The weakness in where I grew up is it became all about systematic theology, and the pattern became a system of teaching so much that it sort of pushed Jesus out of the picture. You obeyed these doctrines because Jesus said to obey them, but quite frankly, you didn't spend a lot of time looking at Jesus. In this passage, when he calls them to be imitators of God, as dearly loved children, the outworking of that, if we're going to be like God, what would that mean? And immediately growing up where I was at, if you're going to please God, and that's what he's asking, if you're really going to be pleasing to God and you're going to be godly, what does it mean? We would have went through a system of things that had to do with morality and purity and doctrinal truth. And all of those things have a role. If you believe in Jesus, then you're going to believe what he says. But it's possible to believe what he says and leave his character to where you're all of a sudden saying, this is, yes, Jesus, and we become mean. I don't know if you guys saw the clip from the abortion doctor, the trial of the abortion doctor who was killed in Kansas, I believe. And it was kind of strange because I watched a piece of that tape, and here's a guy that's on the stand, and he's saying, they asked, did you shoot Dr. So-and-so? Yes, I did. What was your intention? My intention was to kill him. I had thought about hitting him, running him over with a car. I thought about planting a bomb. I finally came to the conclusion the most effective way would be to shoot him in the forehead. Why did you do that? And then he asked, did you murder him? And he said, no, I didn't murder him. I don't believe it was murder because I was protecting the unborn children. And the Bible is very clear that it's wrong to murder. And he even said to kill. And I found this, are you guys the same look? I'm going, what's wrong with this? You know what? Well, what's wrong with it? He's got a truth separated from the character of Jesus. Jesus would never do that to anybody, walk up and take out vengeance while he separated that somehow to where this love, this care for this life has so consumed him that other life doesn't matter and he's become a vigilante. Well, as we talk about being like Jesus at a very broad way, and again, I'm not telling anybody to throw out your doctrine. You know, people who know me, you know, we had a reputation of being kind of liberal in our area, and then preachers who got to know me would say, "Man, Robert, you're more conservative than I am. You're more." And honestly, they weren't just saying that. I believe deeply that there's a reason why God gives us Scripture and He commands us to obey. So don't think that I'm saying just go out and do anything you want. I'm telling you, though, you can do all the little things that are right, and in the absence of a loving lifestyle, it's a waste of time. It's a colossal zero. And that's not my opinion, because later on the same apostle would write, listen, you know, you can have, even if you could fathom all mysteries, if you could take the gray disputable areas out of the text and give God's take on them, and you don't have love, zero. Zilch. Nothing. So one of the things, as we go out, and I find this to be true, there are hurting people everywhere. They're hurting people at every turn. But unless you're a loving person, you won't see them, you won't be drawn to them, nor will they be drawn to you. See, here's the truth. Hurting people are looking for caring people. That's the truth with almost all of us. That when we are hurt, we naturally turn to somebody. I mean, when my daughter, she's 25 years old now, and when she's deeply hurt, I can still expect a phone call. And she still wants to be around her mother or her husband. Why is it like that? Because that's how God programmed us. It's how He made us. We were never designed by God to hurt in isolation. Hurt was designed to be something that would drive us to something that was good. The problem is, hurt, when anything that God gives us something is good, Satan takes it and morphs it, and he turns it into something that's bad. So when somebody's hurting, they're wanting somebody to hold him. That can be a loving believer, or it can be a scandalous infidel. Right? And who they choose is going to be, to a large extent, they're going to, by choosing who they cuddle up to, they're going to choose how the rest of their life turns out. And the sad thing is that as Christians, we have not been known as huggable, lovable people. And I'd like to say it's because, you know, well, right's right and wrong's wrong, but sometimes I think it's just because we have embraced rightness and we've excluded this idea that it must involve a lovingness about us. And we blow it off on our backgrounds, our temperament. Men, we're just really bad about saying, well, I'm just a man, you know, and I'm just not like that. And I thought Christianity was about becoming something you're not. You know, that sort of was like the process I kind of thought, you know, becoming like Christ would mean I'm changing. So Paul challenges them, and he says, listen, if you're going to be like God, live a life of love. So hurting people are looking for caring people, and loving people or caring people are looking for hurting people. If you're living a life of love, when you go out into the world, you're going to go out with a different set of eyes. You will. My problem is I'm so erratic that I have my loving glasses. You know, I have to wear glasses. I can't see anything far away without these. Oh, let me take those back off. No, just kidding. I can't see anything far away without these on, and I can't see anything up close with them on. My problem is with the way that with my mood, one day I go out and I have these great glasses on and I see people the way Jesus did. These are my loving glasses, and I put them on and I see details and I see tears that with these off I don't see. Because you see, whenever I just go through the day, sometimes I can get so preoccupied with everything else that life becomes a blur. That happened to you? It's hard to see hurting people when you're blurred. So every morning when you get up, and it's a commitment that we're going back to some fundamentals at the Crossings. It's kind of ironic that I'm speaking to you guys this week on evangelism, because this last year has been a tough year for me as an evangelist, as a minister, just emotionally. And Shane and I was talking the other day, and he was trying to encourage me, and everything he said, I thought about and I appreciate it, but he doesn't help. It's one of those things to where I told Rita just a few months ago. I said, "Really, you realize we started renting? We outgrew our facility, so we started renting from another Church of Christ that rented us their building on Sunday evenings. We have found that you do not get people. We thought, okay, we'll be able to get people out on Sunday. It'll be good enough, and we'll just do it." And so we kept sort of the same paradigm. For us, our Sunday morning service is sort of like the opening of a funnel, to where that's where we get people to come in, and then we try to funnel them down to a core commitment. We understand that Jesus worked from the crowd to the core. So the opening for us was that Sunday morning. Well, we came to Sunday night. Our first Sunday was Easter Sunday last year. Great bump up day. You know, usually at Greater Alton, if we were running 500 during services normally on Easter, we'd run 700. At the Crossings, if we was running 150, we'd run 225. So it's Sunday evening, and we're thinking, you know, you can't do a sunrise service. You know, that doesn't work. So we decide we're going to do a pancake sausage dinner. Any of you guys ever have breakfast for dinner or for, you know, supper around, I guess, here? So, you know, breakfast. So we thought that's kind of, and made up a really cute little card, you know, had a bunny on it, you know, and stuff. And on the card, we made actually two of them, one with a cave and one with a bunny. And it said, "You can sleep in because he didn't. Join us for a pancake sausage." We handed out, our members handed out almost 3,000 of those personal invitations. We had nobody that showed up because of those invitations. Nobody. I mean, it was horrible. Right? We had so many pancakes. You know, we didn't have a bump in attendance, but all of us gained 30 pounds. So it was like, we're a bigger church this week, you know, from depression. But this will be the whole, this last year, that's been going on. But it's the first year I've been in ministry since 1980 full time. It'll be the first year that the church that I'm working with has not grown numerically. It's not bigger 12 months later than it was the previous year since I've been in ministry. It's not happened. And so we're going back and go, okay, the Sunday night thing is really a problem. But I think God allowed that to happen because he wanted us to know that, you know, that's a problem, but it's not the problem. The problem is that you've got away from the fundamental reality that every disciple is a soul winner. That every disciple is a lover of the lost. And the most important thing that a disciple can do is love people that he's around and be aware of that. So we're backing off and backing up a little bit, and we're saying, okay, whether or not we'll change Sunday evenings at some point and get Sunday morning, but that really shouldn't stop us if we are at our core what God calls us to be. We're just going to have to change the paradigm a little bit. And so we're going back with this idea of let's learn again what it means to walk in the footsteps of Jesus. And our theme for the year is called Learning to Succeed. Only succeed is not rah, 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 shooting off. It's succeed, the transient verb, to walk in the footsteps, to take the place of another, to take the position of one. And we're learning how to reproduce ourselves in the image of Jesus and to be trained and to train others. On a very core level, though, I believe that even with Sunday evenings, that if we can be lovers of people, if every day when we go out, we can realize, listen, I'm not just going to work. I'm going there as a representative of God's love. And if I'm going there as a lover of people, if you love people, hurts stand out like crazy. How many of you had children? How many of you have adult children? For those who have older kids even, you know, when they're little, you know how frantic you get when your kid hurts. It's just like, you know, we went through the kid stage and now we have 6 grandchildren. And I've got kids that are, you know, my son's in his 30s. My daughter is in her mid-20s. And now we've got these rugrats, you know, going around everywhere. And it's kind of weird because it doesn't matter what age they are, if they're hurting, it bothers me. I thought as they got older that it would somehow get better. Because you know how it is, I hated it when the kids were little. How many of you were like this? When they're so small that they hurt and they can't tell you. That was the most frustrating thing when they're crying and you're trying to figure out what's wrong. You know, they can't even, they're just, you know, is it hurt there? And they spit up on you and you don't know if that's a yes or a no. You know, or breath's there and they poop on you. I don't know the how to translate this language. This body fluid language doesn't translate for me. So take them to the doctor and, you know, and they, then you don't even know for sure. Then they get to where they communicate it, and that's kind of good because at least you can go, okay, this is serious. But you never, parents, have you ever had something tragic happen to somebody you love? Doesn't matter. My brother, about 6 weeks ago now, pardon me, December 8th, was in an auto accident. He's paraplegic since then. And it's been a whole range of emotions. I can't even talk about it because, you know, this is my older brother, and we're close, and we, you know, he was a really good older brother, but, you know, older brothers fight with younger brothers. We had a great, but the hardest thing for me, the last 2 weeks, I've been able to get him out of the treatment facility and take him to church. He's been 3 weeks in a row. He preached for me last week in his wheelchair. Did a great, I wasn't there, I was out of town, did a great job. He just said it was kind of weird because he has to because of he has to, every so long he has to lean forward in his wheelchair and just look at the floor for stress release so he doesn't bed sore. So he said it was kind of weird preaching to the floor for a little bit, you know, during a sermon. But, so I pick him up every you know, two of the last 3 weeks and I load him in and help him slide off, you know, out of his wheelchair into the car. And his paraplegic, it's his left arm and his left leg. It's kind of an odd kind of thing. He's lost about 98% of that strength, 99% on that side, and about 70%, he's got about 30, lost 30% on the right side. It would be easier, they said, if he had lost his arms or his legs, which is what normally happens because you can lift or you can pull. With this, you're sort of like, you know, you can imagine the balance. So I'm helping move him in. The hardest thing for me is to take him, though. The hardest thing is when I take him back. And because we get him there late on Sundays, everybody else is in bed, and I take him into that room, and I get him out of that chair, and I leave him there alone. I hate it. You know, I hate it. He is 55 stinking years old. He's bald. He's got a big belly. He's not cuddly and fuzzy, and you're going, why do you feel like that? Because I know he's hurting. And it doesn't matter what age you are, guys. Whenever you love somebody, you notice those things. I can tell when he's bothered instantly when I walk in. And somehow, we've got to broaden that out in our society to where we're looking at people because the hurts that they have are not so obvious as wheelchairs, and that's not what I'm suggesting. Or am I talking about the homeless population? Because on those two extremes, in between those two extremes, are a massive amount of people that are dying inside. And their only pain relief comes from a destroyer of lives who will medicate them for a short period of time to destroy them forever. So we've got to live this life of love, and I can't overstate the importance of that. You've got to see that. So let's jump into Jesus' life here real quick, all right? A man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love is sick. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Now again, what I want you to see again is that whenever she called upon Jesus, the draw was, the one that you love is sick. Come back. She didn't have to question Jesus' love. Why'd she call out to Jesus? Well, probably because she knew he could do miracles later on, we know. But on a core level, she called out to him because she knew this is somebody who cares for him. Here's the same thing for you hurt, and you see people who are hurting when you love them. But people who are hurting can see your love. And they're not going to reach out to people. We have people that I'm just blown away with. They'll come in, they'll tell me about some of the stories and some things they're reaching out to somebody. And all of a sudden, these people, they sat down with them and in 30 minutes, they've got their life story and junk that they've never told anybody. You know, I'm going, how do you do that? I wish I had that knack to get people to open up. You know what I think that knack is? I think it's genuine compassion, concern, and love that opens the door. I don't think it's a knack. I think it's a decision, a command that Jesus gave that we can embrace. So with Jesus, whenever Lazarus is hurting, the reason that he reaches out to them is because he knows that he loves him. So I want to live in such a way that if somebody is hurt around me, if I go into a store, if I go into a restaurant, and I've been in there consistently, if that waitress has got a problem, I am hoping that at some point she'll say, could I talk to you for a second? And she does that, not because I'm a preacher, because quite frankly, it doesn't happen if you're a preacher. It shuts it down if you're a preacher. If you're a lover, it opens it up. Incredibly, incredibly well. But I want them to be able to look at me. So if you're going to do evangelism on a level, you've got to live a life of love. And that means that you stop thinking about yourself all the time. You start thinking about others and realize there are hurting people that are out there. The only way the gospel is going to get in their life is if it permeates it through you. The only way you're going to get close enough to have this sort of osmosis kind of Jesus transfer is if they know you care. So if you don't do that as a church, and as a church, that's kind of, if you don't do that as an individual, you'll never be effective evangelistically. Live a life of love. Secondly, hold out hope. When somebody's hurting, and I tell all of our small group leaders this, that anytime they get with anybody, this is, and we are a mentoring church that does training. Our people, you know, are not from church backgrounds by and large. They didn't grow up in the church. So we have the idea that we want to reach people that are going to grow up to become mature, and then we're going to plant other churches with that core group. Everybody at the Crossings Church, the 35 people that started that, out of that, probably 25 adults, I'm guessing, or 30, every one of them I saw baptized except one. And none of them, other than my kids, have a heritage in the Church of Christ past us. So these are all, so we have this idea of, you know, we've got to train these guys. They don't know about Christ. They don't know about, you know, they've not got the background. And so when we're training them to reach people and to develop people, and when they're in conflict and when they're doing counseling and when they're talking with people, I'll let them know that the most important thing you do, you got to remember every time that you get with people, you've got to hold up Jesus. And you got to hold out hope. Now, those two should be very similar. But if in a situation where they're even if somebody's involved, and we've had people, guys, that have involved in homosexuality, people that have been involved in bestiality, people that are involved in violent crimes. We've been involved with girls who have been so immoral that the Samaritan woman wouldn't hang out with her. You know what I mean? Really, really. And when you get with those people, it's really easy just to be overwhelmed and go, how can I help them? Well, here's what I know from 30 years of ministry. The key to helping them is giving them what Jesus promises they have. That's hope. A confident expectation that things can be different. I've got a kid living with me right now. He's not a kid. He's near 40, probably close to it, I'm guessing. Became a Christian at the first church that I was ever at full time. Has had a rough life, found out after I'd left that church, he was a teenager, and after I'd left, he found out that his father had abused him when he was younger, but he never talked with me about that whenever I was there, didn't have any clue of that, has had emotional problems, has been through three divorces, I think, or two divorces or three, going through another one right now, emotional roller coaster, has called me twice, once with a gun in his mouth, second after ODing, and I found somehow located a doctor who would treat him. He would have died if he hadn't got to the emergency room and treated him and didn't turn him in. And so I got this guy that's living with me and has screwed up so badly that it is hard for him to even want to do what's right, to even think about Christ. You know, and so I was talking to him the other day and I said, John, listen, that's not his name, but I said, John, listen, you know, you need to know that there's hope. I said, you know, one of the things I know you're like, you're always negative, you're a roller coaster. But do you realize that Jesus promises you that things can be different? And that the best part of your life, John, is not what's... I know your glory days weren't whenever he was a teenager, because that's what he looks back when he came to art, when I was the preacher there, and he almost lived with us. And that was his, that was the only happy time of his life, or the only extended happy... And that's where he lives. And he doesn't make any changes because he doesn't think he's capable. It doesn't matter what he does, that it's going to end horribly. He told me the other day he's always had premonition since he's about 8 years old that he would end his life by suicide. Well, if you think there's no purpose in living, if you think there's no hope, I'm telling you, why not commit suicide? The people that are out there, some of them that you and I look at and go, well, they're just worthless. They just don't care. It's not that they don't care. It's that they don't think there's any reason to care because there's no hope for them. Mary calls out for Lazarus, for Jesus, in John chapter 11, verse 4. But when Jesus heard about it, he said, Lazarus' sickness will not end in death. No, it happened for the glory of God, so that the Son of Man will receive glory from this. Now again, notice what Jesus doesn't go. You guys know the story. Jesus doesn't go immediately to see Mary and Martha. But instead, he lets Lazarus die. He lets him, and it's like, man, what? That's bad. And yet, whenever the disciples talk to him, whenever Jesus talks to Martha and Mary, there's not a hopelessness, but he says, listen, this isn't going to end in death. This was all designed to bring glory to God. You know, people need to know that their sin isn't going to end, that just because they're divorced, their life isn't over. Just because they've been addicted, their life isn't over. Just because they've been sexually abused, their life isn't over. And there's a whole plethora that you could of sins and struggles that you could list that people just cave into and get depressed and give up because they think life's over. Figuratively, I'm dead. There's no hope for me. And one of the things that you and I need to be as we love people is we need to be people who are realizing that my role is to love them, and part of loving them is to inspire them to hope and know that, listen, this doesn't have to end in death. You don't have to go downhill from here. Quite frankly, this may be the thing that God uses to bring glory to you, to Him, and to make you useful in a way that you've never imagined. It's an incredible thing when somebody shares something, you go, oh man, that's horrible. But man, you need to know it's not over. In 1 Peter 3:15, the Bible says, have reverence for Christ in your hearts and honor Him as Lord. Be ready at all times to answer anyone who asks you to explain the hope you have in you. What's your hope of salvation? It better not be on your ability to perform well. Well, I just do things well, so God's going to need me up there. That's a major wrong answer, okay? Well, I got it all right. And so our hope is in the grace of Jesus Christ and the transforming power of God. That's where our hope is, those two things. And if it's the grace of God and the transforming power of God is your hope and mine, is it limited to you and I? Is it limited to the semi-good or the pretty good? Or the really bad that think they're great? Like the religious Pharisees, are they? So live a life of love, hold out hope. Number three, remember reality. Don't be trite is what I want you to know. Jesus then added, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'll go and wake him up. The disciples answers, if he's asleep, Lord, he'll get well. Let him sleep. Let's not go all that way. Jesus meant that Lazarus had died. So Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus is dead. Some things that you and I can do as we try to reach people sometimes if we're not careful, we would trivialize their struggle. Oh, just give it to God. And I believe you need to give it to God. But you have a hard time where you see the idea that giving it to God is the end all solution. Biblically, especially you see in the ministry of Jesus in the New Testament church, giving it to God always meant sharing it with another person. And if overcoming struggles were as simple as giving it to God, then there would have been no reason for a dozen or so verses that the Bible gives us about spurring each other on, about bearing each other's burdens, about our confessing our struggles, about our supporting each other, about getting hope from someone when God puts them in our lives. So when somebody has a struggle, it's really important that you don't do one of two things. You don't go, oh, because you're so grossed out. The other night I mentioned bestiality in the studies. We were studying Galatians 5 in the list of sins, sexual immorality, that bestiality is underneath that that umbrella description. If you describe somebody's sexual immorality, bestiality in the original context was underneath that. And I looked, and there's about four or five of our members, one especially, who just got this, you know, was acting like she was vomiting. Well, the only problem is we've had several people attend our church who have been involved in bestiality. Now, guys, I'm not saying it's not gross, and I'm not saying it's not wrong. But if they think they're going to walk into a place where members, every time they see them, are about to throw up and they're gagging themselves, they're probably not going to show up. And even though it's gross and wrong, we sort of need to get the idea that, let's see, sin separates, not gross sin. Right? You know, our sin doesn't stink. Theirs does. So you don't want to have that extreme to where you're so grossed out. Or on the other side to where it's like, oh, no big deal. No problem. Come on, divorce, big deal. Just get back on the, you just need to get back in the saddle again and just get over it. Those two extremes will destroy hope. Jesus just says, listen, guys, I'm not trivializing. He's dead. And you're going to see Jesus as we go on down, because of his understanding of that reality, he doesn't come in a jovial manner, even though he knows the end of this is going to glorify God and it's going to be a celebration. He cares for the people enough not to insult them by his insensitivity. So remember reality. Guys, it's tough. I don't know if you guys struggle with sin the way that the world struggles with sin. I do know the answer to that. I guess I don't know if we'll admit that. You know, do we really sometimes acknowledge how hard it is to be what Christ wants us to be? And our selfishness may just be in, we may not go out and murder somebody. You know, we may just let them go to hell without ever speaking to them. First John, doesn't John say there's kind of a, you know, there's this, if you have hatred to somebody, you're sort of like a murderer, kind of got that thing there. So we may not have the technicolor. Remember when the TV came out and it was in technicolor? We may be black and white in our sin. But I'm telling you, doing the right thing is difficult because of Satan's power. So don't trivialize somebody. But instead, number four, connect with compassion. Mary arrived where Jesus was, and as soon as she saw him, she fell at his feet. Lord, she said, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. Now notice what it says. Jesus saw her weeping. He saw how the people with her were weeping also. His heart was touched. When you see people weeping, when you see a group weeping, what is your heart's reaction? If I'm not careful, I can become very judgmental and I can just not care at all. Jesus, when he saw those people weeping, rather than, even though he knew the outcome, he decides to connect with them and his heart is touched and he was deeply moved. Where have you buried him? He asked them. Come and see, they answered. Favorite trivia question for kids in Bible class, right? What's the shortest verse in the Bible? Jesus wept. What's the least imitated action of Jesus Christ among men in the 21st century church? Jesus wept. One is trivial, the other isn't. The shortest verse, I don't give a rip what it is. Whether we care for people and weep like Jesus, whether I do or not, it bothers me. Whenever I know that I'm insensitive and I'm hard-hearted, I'm self-righteous, and I don't see people. That's not trivial. That's a huge deal. And I've got to learn to connect with compassion. Jesus wept. Now notice what happens in verse 36. See how much he loved him, the people said. These tears that are coming down communicate love with a depth to a pagan culture, to a culture that's not necessarily God-centered, but it communicates love in almost any culture. I've had people say, you know, whenever I talk to them, I feel so stupid because I start crying with them and I just got to maintain. And I always tell them, you don't have to maintain. Don't go nuts, okay? You know, you've got to be able to talk, but it's okay for you to cry with them. Is there anything, honestly, that means more to you than to have people cry with you? I mean, isn't it this bonding time with my brother? And again, he's the illustration for a lot of this. He was in the Barnes Hospital during Christmas, so we moved all of our Christmas celebration. My family, my sons and my daughter and my grandkids, all of them, and his kids, all except one, got to come home for Christmas. And so we're with his grandkids. We're up in that room, you know, and we're trading gifts. And it's kind of hot in the room because there's like 30 people in this hot, the private hospital room. Hospital was gracious with us. And Steve wanted to sing. You know, he just wanted to, he said, he goes, the two things right after, like, he said, I need some Christian music to listen to. If not, I'm going to get discouraged. And he told me, he goes, I just want to worship God. I want to get together with the church. I want to sing. I want to be with the worship team. So he couldn't do any of that. So we go over there. And we, after our Christmas celebration, Steve goes, before we leave, could we sing some songs? So we sang some of his, you know, favorite songs, like two or three of them. I don't remember what they were. And I don't remember what the third one was that we sang, like four or five. I don't remember what the third one was, but it was the Showstopper. Pardon me? Was that it? I'm Trading My Sorrows. I don't know if you guys know that song or not. But it's I'm Trading My Sorrows. He wanted to sing that. So we're singing, and we're all doing, you know, we've got some pretty good singers in it. My daughter sings well. My son sings well. My wife sings well. I sing also. And okay, there's a little difference between well and also. But so we're singing, you know, and stuff, and all of us are fine, you know, we're feeling good. And then I don't know if we simultaneously looked at my brother or what, but there's a portion of that song where you start clapping. And we're singing, and I'm struggling, honestly, anyway. I'm a bald baby when it comes to things like that, anyway. But then all of a sudden we look over, and here's my brother trying to clap, and he can't get his hands together. And his arms are just flailing. The song quiets down really quickly because I start crying, look over, his daughter is turned away and is just bawling now. And so we're still trying to sing because he's still singing and, you know, you're still going at it and stuff. And he knew that what was going on a little bit. So after it was over, he looked up at me and he said, he goes, this accident hasn't helped my clapping at all, has it? And all of us just have this mutual embrace of him. And it was like, I don't know what metal conducts electricity most effectively, whether it's aluminum or copper. But I know that the most effective communicator of love sometimes and a conductor of love is human tears. That it speaks and conducts a level of love that is deeper and more sincere than any other way of communicating. So as we're with those hurting people, it's okay, guys. It's okay to hurt with them. It's okay. This last week in my small group, there's a guy that we've been reaching out to for a long time. His wife is a spender, and she's built up secret debt on him. They don't make great money. He's a bricklayer. He's a great guy. She's a great girl, but they don't make great money. But she has built up over about two major times now, over $100,000 in credit card debt. And he has forgiven her and worked with her this last week. She got a payday loan, had to pay back $500 on a $200 loan, snuck into him, got his papers and got his PIN number and took it out of his account, hoping he wouldn't find it. He found it. It's not the $500 that's there. It's the feeling of betrayal after he's forgiven her all these times. She's in the other room during our guy time, girl time in our small group. We do this because it gives us a chance. And I'm looking at this guy and thinking, what's the magic words? Bingo. No, that's not going to help, you know. I don't know what to say. So all of us just go up. I say, guys, let's just pray for John. And we all go put our arms around him. And during that prayer, I hear somebody sniffling. I don't know who it was. It wasn't him, though, because I was right by this guy. Somebody's sniffling. And whenever we go away, I see tears in this guy's eyes. He's a very masculine man. Mason, bricklayer, you know, union guy, way back. You know what I'm saying? And it was so cool later on because he's thinking about leaving and everything else. And they come back in and we have a time where we're going to praise God. And his wife says, I want to praise God for my husband. And I just, for sticking with me. And I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm going to get through this. And it was so cool when she said that, because a lot of people didn't hear Rick's response. Because from the other side of the room, he said, we're going to get through this. We're going to get through this. And I am convinced that his ability to say that we're going to get through this was fortified by a group of men who came up and put their arms on him and prayed for him and connected with him. Didn't have any magical words. Didn't have any great solutions. Quite frankly, most of us are thinking, I'd kick her out and, you know, have a part. You know, probably. But we resisted our masculine temptation for a wiser path. And I think it made a difference. You see, the love of the righteous is powerful and effective. Those who plant with tears will harvest with shouts of joy. They'll weep as they go and plant their seed, but they'll sing as they return with the harvest. The rain that waters the seed is the tears of those who care. Center them on Christ, number five. Got to point them to Christ. Jesus answered. Martha answered, I'm sorry. I know he'll rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? He brings it back to the core gospel. And I'm telling you guys, the truth is, you don't do anybody any favor by patting them on the back and giving them some kind of endorphin rush to where they feel better and have them walk away without knowing Jesus is the only solution to the long-term problem. If he doesn't die now, he'll die later without Jesus. So it doesn't matter whether he comes to life now or not if he doesn't understand this about Jesus. So in all of my talks, whenever I see somebody who is hurting, I know that my goal is that there is something, a cancer within them that is eating away at their soul, and my goal is to inject the cure for that cancer, and that's the message of Jesus Christ. I've got to get it in. And when they're hurting, they'll open up in a way that they never will when they're whole. In 2 Corinthians 1, Paul said this, praise be to God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion, the God of all comfort, who comforts us in our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves have received. Notice what it says, from God. We're not just comforting like anybody else. We're not comforting like some secular psychologist or some best friend who's in the club or who goes to the soccer game with them. We have a different level of comfort. And to leave God out of it and to somehow go, well, I just want to make him feel good. And for what reason? I think last time I was here, I told you, we told our group that was of alcoholics that, listen, guys, if all you're going to do is get them sober, you don't do them a favor. If they're going to hell, they'd rather go drunk. Right? No favor. And then finally, in all of this, ask God for assistance when you're dealing with hurting people. They go out to the stone, to the tomb. Jesus says, go ahead, take the stone away. They remove the stone. Jesus raised his eyes to heaven and prayed. Why did he do that? Well, maybe it was just an acknowledgement. Apparently, he had talked with God before, and he knew the power that he had. But he involves God. He says, Father, I'm grateful that you have listened to me. I know that you always do listen. But on account of this crowd standing here, I've spoken so that they might believe that you sent me. His prayer was about not simply the healing of Lazarus, but it was about the salvation of the people that was around him. And so he wanted to make sure that his Father knew that, and that they knew that this was about God. And one of the things that I'm trying to do, and I feel, some of the couples that Reed and I have been reaching out to, we've had some difficult, long-term, really difficult people that we dealt with in the last year and a half in our small group. Half of our small group, about half, has never been baptized into Christ. And we have been working with them, but there have been explosions in their marriages. There's been these financial things that are going on. There's been problems with their kids. And every time we get going some way, it seems like we're about there and something blows up. And both of us have been really frustrated. And it's like, I'm just feeling like we're giving up. And then I started asking myself, how much have I been praying about these people? Specifically, every day, by name, consistently begging? Have I spent a day fasting? You know, we spent several days over the last year, few months fasting because we were trying to buy some land. And all the banks were saying, no, you guys have, you know, your contribution isn't high enough. You've got big attendance because of the college students coming in. And we have such a overwhelming campus and teen ministry that you know, we have a lot of people, but you don't get a lot of money from a campus student or a teen, okay? That's what those campus students get from you guys, right? You parents know that, all right? So we've been praying, God, open a door for us, and we're fasting over that. But we're not fasting over these lost people that we've not been able to break through. God, break through those minds, open doors financially. Help us to help somebody have a heart that's inclined. Remember Nehemiah. But we're not praying that same thing about the people with the struggles in our group. And saying, remember Lazarus. Remember Jesus. As if you're going to make a difference, just look for hurts. And that foundation, again, is you got to live a life of love. Man, that goes against our nature sometimes because we're going to go get this, get back, and we don't notice anything that's not, I'm like that. But if you're going to be evangelistic, you guys as individuals, this is not a corporate thing. It's not a corporate thing. This is an individual thing. Now, we're going to take a break here for about 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Is that good, Shane? 15 minutes. Come back about 20 after here. And we're going to have some questions. And we're going to talk about just the opposite extreme of how do you engage people in good stuff to win them for Christ. All right? So if you'll be back here at 20 after, that'd be great.